The Landlady, also known as The Hostess, written by Fyodor Dostoevsky. Part 1. Chapter 1. Ordynov had made up his mind at last to change his lodgings. The landlady with whom he lodged, the poor and elderly widow of a petty functionary, was leaving Petersburg for some reason or other, and setting off to a remote province to live with relations, before the first of the month, when his time at the lodging was up. Staying on till his time was up, the young man thought regretfully of his old quarters, and felt vexed at having to leave them. He was poor, and lodgings were dear. The day after his landlady went away, he took his cap and went out to wander about the back streets of Petersburg, looking at all the bills stuck up on the gates of the houses, and choosing by preference the dingiest and most populous blocks of buildings, where there was always more chance of finding a corner in some poor tenant's flat. He had been looking for a long time, very carefully, but soon he was visited by new, almost unknown sensations. He looked about him at first carelessly and absent-mindedly, then with attention, and finally with intense curiosity. The crowd and bustle of the street, the noise, the movement, the novelty of objects and the novelty of his position, all the paltry, everyday triviality of town life so wearisome to a busy Petersburger spending his whole life in the fruitless effort to gain by toil, by sweat, and by various other means a snug little home in which to rest in peace and quiet, all this vulgar prose and dreariness aroused in Ordynov, on the contrary, a sensation of gentle gladness and serenity. His pale cheeks began to be suffused with a faint blush, his eyes began to shine as though with new hope, and he drew deep and eager breaths of the cold, fresh air. He felt unusually light-hearted. He always led a quiet and absolutely solitary life. 3 years before, after taking his degree and becoming to a great extent his own master, he went to see an old man whom he had known only at second hand, and was kept waiting a long while before the liveried servants consented to take his name in a second time. Then he walked into a dark, lofty, and deserted room, one of those dreary-looking rooms still to be found in old-fashioned family mansions that have been spared by time, and saw in it a grey-headed old man hung with orders of distinction, who had been the friend and colleague of his father, and was his guardian. The old man handed him a tiny screw of notes. It turned out to be a very small sum. It was all that was left of his ancestral estates, which had been sold by auction to pay the family debts. Ordynov accepted his inheritance unconcernedly, took leave forever of his guardian, and went out into the street. It was a cold, gloomy autumn evening. The young man was dreamy, and his heart was torn with a sort of unconscious sadness. There was a glow of fire in his eyes. He felt feverish, and was hot and chilly by turns. He calculated on the way that on his money he could live for 2 or 3 years, or even on half rations for 4 years. It grew dusk, and began to drizzle with rain. He had taken the first corner he came across, and within an hour had moved into it. There he shut himself up, as though he were in a monastery, as though he had renounced the world. Within 2 years he had become a complete recluse. He had grown shy and unsociable without being aware of the fact. Meanwhile, it never occurred to him that there was another sort of life, full of noise and uproar, of continual excitement, of continual variety, which was inviting him, and was, sooner or later, inevitable. It is true that he could not avoid hearing of it, but he had never known it or sought to know it. From childhood his life had been exceptional, and now it was more exceptional than ever. He was devoured by the deepest and most insatiable passion, which absorbs a man's whole life and does not, for beings like Ordynov, provide any niche in the domain of practical daily activity. This passion was science. Meanwhile, It was consuming his youth, marring his rest at nights with its slow, intoxicating poison, robbing him of wholesome food and of fresh air which never penetrated to his stifling corner. Yet, intoxicated by his passion, Ordynov refused to notice it. He was young, and so far asked for nothing more. His passion made him a babe as regards external existence, and totally incapable of forcing other people to stand aside when needful to make some sort of place for himself among them. Some clever people's science is a capital in their hands. For Ordynov, it was a weapon turned against himself. He was prompted rather by an instinctive impulse than by a logical, clearly defined motive for studying and knowing. And it was the same in every other work he had done hitherto, even the most trivial. Even as a child he had been thought queer and unlike his schoolfellows. He had never known his parents. He had to put up with coarse and brutal treatment from his schoolfellows, provoked by his odd and unsociable disposition, and that made him really unsociable and morose. And little by little he grew more and more secluded in his habits. But there never had been, and was not even now, any order and system in his solitary studies. Even now he had only the first ecstasy, the first fever, the first delirium of the artist. He was creating a system for himself. It was being evolved in him by the years. And the dim, vague, but marvellously soothing image of an idea, embodied in a new, clarified form, was gradually emerging in his soul. And this form craved expression, fretting his soul. He was still timidly aware of its originality, its truth, its independence. Creative genius was already showing. It was gathering strength and taking shape. But the moment of embodiment and creation was still far off. Perhaps very far off. Perhaps altogether impossible. Now he walked about the streets like a recluse, like a hermit who has suddenly come from his dumb wilderness into the noisy, roaring city. Everything seemed to him new and strange. But he was so remote from all the world that was surging and clattering around him that he did not wonder at his own strange sensation. He seemed unconscious of his own aloofness. On the contrary, there was springing up in his heart a joyful feeling, a sort of intoxication, like the ecstasy of a hungry man who has meat and drink set before him after a long fast, though of course it was strange that such a trivial novelty as a change of lodgings could excite and thrill any inhabitant of Petersburg, even Ordynov. But the truth is that it had scarcely ever happened to him to go out with a practical object. He enjoyed wandering about the streets more and more. He stared about at everything like a flaneur. But even now, inconsequent as ever, he was reading significance in the picture that lay so brightly before him, as though between the lines of a book. Everything struck him. He did not miss a single impression, and looked with thoughtful eyes into the faces of passing people, watched the characteristic aspect of everything around him, and listened lovingly to the speech of the people, as though verifying in everything the conclusions that had been formed in the stillness of solitary nights. Often some trifle impressed him, gave rise to an idea, and, for the first time, he felt vexed that he had so buried himself alive in his cell. Here, everything moved more swiftly. His pulse was full and rapid. His mind, which had been oppressed by solitude, had been stirred and uplifted only by strained, exalted activity, worked now swiftly, calmly, and boldly. Moreover, he had an unconscious longing to squeeze himself somehow into this life which was so strange to him, of which he had hitherto known, or rather correctly divined, only by the instinct of the artist. His heart began instinctively throbbing with a yearning for love and sympathy. He looked more attentively at the people who passed by him. But they were strangers, preoccupied and absorbed in thought. And by degrees, Ordynov's careless light-heartedness began unconsciously to pass away. reality began to weigh upon him, and to inspire in him a sort of unconscious dread and awe. He began to be weary from the surfeit of new impressions, like an invalid who, for the first time, joyfully gets up from his sickbed and sinks down giddy and stupefied by the movement and exhausted by the light, the glare, the whirl of life, the noise and medley of colours in the crowd that flutters by him. He began to feel dejected and miserable. He began to be full of dread for his whole life, for his work, and even for the future. A new idea destroyed his peace. A thought suddenly occurred to him that all his life he had been solitary and no one had loved him. And indeed, he had succeeded in loving no one either. Some of the passers-by, with whom he had chanced to enter into conversation at the beginning of his walk, had looked at him rudely and strangely. He saw that they took him for a madman, or a very original, eccentric fellow, which was indeed perfectly correct. He remembered that everyone was always somewhat ill at ease in his presence, that even in his childhood everyone had avoided him on account of his dreamy, obstinate character, that sympathy for people had always been difficult and oppressive to him, and had been unnoticed by others, for though it existed in him, there was no moral equality perceptible in it, a fact which had worried him even as a child, when he was utterly unlike other children of his own age. Now he remembered and reflected that always, at all times, he had been left out and passed over by everyone. Without noticing it, he had come into an end of Petersburg, remote from the centre of the town. Dining after a fashion in a solitary restaurant, he went out to wander about again. Again he passed through many streets and squares. After them stretched long fences, grey and yellow. He began to come across quite dilapidated little cottages instead of wealthy houses, and mingled with them colossal factories, monstrous, soot-begrimed red buildings with long chimneys. All round it was deserted and desolate. Everything looked grim and forbidding, so at least it seemed to Ardinov. It was by now evening. He came out of a long side street into a square where there stood a parish church. He went into it without thinking. The service was just over. The church was almost empty. Only two old women were kneeling near the entrance. The verger, a grey-headed old man, was putting out the candles. The rays of the setting sun were streaming down from above through a narrow window in the cupola, and flooding one of the chapels with a sea of brilliant light. But it grew fainter and fainter, and the blacker the darkness that gathered under the vaulted roof, the more brilliantly glittered in places the gilt icons, reflecting the flickering glow of the lamps and the lights. In an access of profound depression and some stifled feeling, Ardinov leaned against the wall in the darkest corner of the church and, for an instant, sank into forgetfulness. He came to himself when the even, hollow sound of the footsteps of two persons resounded in the building. He raised his eyes, and an indescribable curiosity took possession of him at the sight of the two advancing figures. They were an old man and a young woman. The old man was tall, still upright and hale-looking, but thin and of a sickly pallor. From his appearance, he might have been taken for a merchant from some distant province. He was wearing a long, black, full-skirted coat trimmed with fur, evidently a holiday dress, and he wore it unbuttoned. Under it could be seen some other long-skirted Russian garment, buttoned closely from top to bottom. His bare neck was covered with a bright red handkerchief, carelessly knotted. In his hands he held a fur cap. His thin, long, grizzled beard fell down to his chest, and fiery, feverishly glowing eyes flashed a haughty, prolonged stare from under his frowning, overhanging brows. The woman was about 20, and wonderfully beautiful. She wore a splendid blue fur-trimmed jacket, and her head was covered with a white satin kerchief tied under her chin. She walked with her eyes cast down, and a sort of melancholy dignity pervaded her whole figure, and was vividly and mournfully reflected in the sweet contours of the childishly soft, mild lines of her face. There was something strange in this surprising couple. The old man stood still in the middle of the church, and bowed to all the four points of the compass, though the church was quite empty. His companion did the same. Then he took her by the hand, and led her up to the big icon of the Virgin to whom the church was dedicated. It was shining on the altar, with the dazzling light of the candles reflected on the gold and precious stones of the setting. The church verger, the last one remaining in the church, bowed respectfully to the old man. The latter nodded to him. The woman fell on her face before the icon. The old man took the hem of the veil that hung at the pedestal of the icon and covered her head. A muffled sob echoed through the church. Ordynov was impressed by the solemnity of this scene and waited in impatience for its conclusion. 2 minutes later, the woman raised her head, and again the bright light of the lamp fell on her charming face. Ordynov started and took a step forward. She had already given her hand to the old man, and they both walked quietly out of the church. Tears were welling up from her dark blue eyes under the long eyelashes that glistened against the milky pallor of her face and were rolling down her pale cheeks. There was a glimpse of a smile on her lips, but there were traces in her face of some childlike fear and mysterious horror. She pressed timidly close to the old man, and it could be seen that she was trembling from emotion. Overwhelmed, tormented by a sweet and persistent feeling that was novel to him, Ordynov followed them quickly and overtook them in the church porch. The old man looked at him with unfriendly churlishness. She glanced at him too, but absent-mindedly, without curiosity, as though her mind were absorbed by some faraway thought. Ordynov followed them without understanding his own action. By now it had grown quite dark. He followed at a little distance. The old man and the young woman turned into a long, wide, dirty street full of hucksters' booths, corn chandlers' shops and taverns, leading straight to the city gates, and turned from it into a long, narrow lane, with long fences on each side of it, running alongside the huge blackened wall of a four-storied block of buildings, by the gates of which one could pass into another street, also big and crowded. They were approaching the house. Suddenly the old man turned round and looked with impatience at Ordynov. The young man stood still as though he had been shot. He felt himself how strange his impulsive conduct was. The old man looked round once more, as though he wanted to assure himself that his menacing gaze had produced its effect, and then the two of them, he and the young woman, went in at the narrow gate of the courtyard. Ordynov turned back. He was in the most discontented humour and was vexed with himself, reflecting that he had wasted his day, that he had tired himself for nothing, and had ended foolishly by magnifying into an adventure an incident that was absolutely ordinary. However severe he had been with himself in the morning for his recluse habits, yet it was instinctive with him to shun anything that might distract him, impress and shock him in his external, not in his internal, artistic worlds. Now he thought mournfully and regretfully of his sheltered corner, and he was overcome by depression and anxiety about his unsettled position and the exertions before him. At last, exhausted and incapable of putting two ideas together, he made his way late at night to his lodging and realized with amazement that he had been about to pass the house in which he lived. Dumbfounded, he shook his head and put down his absent-mindedness to fatigue, and, going up the stairs, at last reached his garret under the roof. There he lighted a candle, and a minute later the image of the weeping woman rose vividly before his imagination. So glowing, so intense was the impression, so longingly did his heart reproduce those mild, gentle features, quivering with mysterious emotion and horror, and bathed in tears of ecstasy or childish penitence, that there was a mist before his eyes, and a thrill of fire seemed to run through all his limbs. But the vision did not last long. After enthusiasm, after ecstasy, came reflection, then vexation, then impotent anger. Without undressing, he threw himself on his hard bed. Arvinov woke up rather late in the morning, in a nervous, timid and depressed state of mind. He hurriedly got ready, almost forcing himself to concentrate his mind on the practical problems before him, and set off in the opposite direction from that he had taken on his pilgrimage the day before. At last he found a lodging, a little room in the flat of a poor German called Spies, who lived alone with a daughter called Tinchen. On receiving a deposit, Spies instantly took down the notice that was nailed on the gate to attract lodgers, complimented Ardinov on his devotion to science, and promised to work with him zealously himself. Ardinov said that he would move in the evening. From there he was going home, but changed his mind and turned off in the other direction. His self-confidence had returned, and he smiled at his own curiosity. In his impatience, the way seemed very long to him. At last he reached the church in which he had been the evening before. Evening service was going on. He chose a place from which he could see almost all the congregation, but the figures he was looking for were not there. After waiting a long time, he went away blushing. Resolutely suppressing in himself an involuntary feeling, he tried obstinately to force himself to change the current of his thoughts. Reflecting on everyday practical matters, he remembered he had not had dinner, and, feeling that he was hungry, he went into the same tavern in which he had dined the day before. Unconsciously, he sauntered a long time about the streets, through crowded and deserted alleys, and at last came out into a desolate region where the town ended in a vista of fields that were turning yellow. He came to himself when the death-like silence struck him by its strangeness and unfamiliarity. It was a dry and frosty day such as are frequent in Petersburg in October. Not far away was a cottage, and near it stood two haystacks. A little horse with prominent ribs was standing unharnessed, with drooping head and lip thrust out, beside a little two-wheeled gig, and seemed to be pondering over something. A watchdog, growling, gnawed a bone beside a broken wheel, and a child of three who, with nothing on but his shirt, was engaged in combing his shaggy white head, stared in wonder at the solitary stranger from the town. Behind the cottage there was a stretch of field and cottage garden. There was a dark patch of forest against the blue sky on the horizon, and on the opposite side were thick snow clouds, which seemed chasing before them a flock of flying birds, moving noiselessly one after another across the sky. All was still, and, as it were, solemnly melancholy, full of a palpitating, hidden suspense. Ardinov was walking on farther and farther, but the desolation weighed upon him. He turned back to the town, from which there suddenly floated the deep clamour of bells ringing for evening service. He redoubled his pace, and within a short time he was again entering the church that had been so familiar to him since the day before. The unknown woman was there already. She was kneeling at the very entrance among the crowd of worshippers. Ardinov forced his way through the dense mass of beggars, old women in rags, sick people and cripples who were waiting for alms at the church door, and knelt down beside the stranger. His clothes touched her clothes, and he heard the breath that came irregularly from her lips as she whispered a fervent prayer. As before, her features were quivering with a feeling of boundless devotion, and tears again were falling and drying on her burning cheeks, as though washing away some fearful crime. It was quite dark in the place where they were both kneeling, and only from time to time the dim flame of the lamp flickering in the draught from the narrow open window pane threw a quivering glimmer on her face, every feature of which printed itself on the young man's memory, making his eyes swim and rending his heart with a vague, insufferable pain. But this torment had a peculiar, intense ecstasy of its own. At last he could not endure it. His breast began shuddering and aching, all in one instant, with a sweet and unfamiliar yearning, and, bursting into sobs, he bowed down with his feverish head to the cold pavement of the church. He saw nothing and felt nothing but the ache in his heart, which thrilled with sweet anguish. This extreme impressionability, sensitiveness, and lack of resisting power may have been developed by solitude, or this impulsiveness of heart may have been evolved in the exhausting, suffocating, and hopeless silence of long, sleepless nights, in the midst of unconscious yearnings and impatient stirrings of spirit, till it was ready at last to explode and find an outlet. Or it may have been simply that the time for that solemn moment had suddenly arrived, and it was as inevitable as when, on a sullen, stifling day, the whole sky grows suddenly black, and a storm pours rain and fire on the parched earth, hangs pearly drops on the emerald twigs, beats down the grass, the crops, crushes to the earth the tender cups of the flowers, in order that afterwards, at the first rays of sun, everything, reviving again, may shine and rise to meet it, and triumphantly lift to the sky its sweet, luxuriant incense, glad and rejoicing in its new life. But Ordynov could not think now what was the matter with him. He was scarcely conscious. He hardly noticed how the service ended, and only recovered his senses as he threaded his way after his unknown lady through the crowd that thronged the entrance. At times he met her clear and wondering eyes. Stopped every minute by the people passing out, she turned round to him more than once. He could see that her surprise grew greater and greater, and all at once she flushed a fiery red. At that minute the same old man came forward again out of the crowd and took her by the arm. Ordynov met his morose and sarcastic stare again, and a strange anger suddenly gripped his heart. At last he lost sight of them in the darkness. Then, with a superhuman effort, he pushed forward and got out of the church. But the fresh evening air could not restore him. His breathing felt oppressed and stifled, and his heart began throbbing slowly and violently, as though it would have burst his breast. At last he saw that he really had lost his strangers. They were neither in the main street nor in the alley. But already a thought had come to Ordynov, and in his mind was forming one of those strange, decisive projects which almost always succeed when they are carried out, in spite of their wildness. At 8 o'clock next morning he went to the house from the side of the alley and walked into a narrow, filthy, and unclean backyard which was like an open cesspool in a house. The porter, who was doing something in the yard, stood still, leaned with his chin on the handle of his spade, looked Ordynov up and down, and asked him what he wanted. The porter was a little fellow, about 25, a Tartar with an extremely old-looking face, covered with wrinkles. "I'm looking for a lodging," Ordynov answered impatiently. "Which?" asked the porter with a grin. He looked at Ordynov as if he knew all about him. "I want a furnished room in a flat," answered Ordynov. "There's none in that yard," the porter answered enigmatically. "And here?" "None here either." The porter took up his spade again. "Perhaps they will let me have one," said Ardinov, giving the porter 10 kopecks. The Tartar glanced at Ardinov, took the 10 kopecks, then took up his spade again, and after a brief silence announced that, "No, there was no lodging." But the young man did not hear him. He walked along the rotten, shaking planks that lay in the pool towards the one entrance from that yard into the lodge of the house, a black, filthy, muddy entrance that looked as though it were drowning in the pool. In the lower story lived a poor coffin-maker. Passing by his cheering workshop, Ardinov clambered by a half-broken, slippery spiral staircase to the upper story, felt in the darkness a heavy, clumsy door covered with rags of sacking, found the latch and opened it. He was not mistaken. Before him stood the same old man, looking at him intently with extreme surprise.
"What do you want?"
he asked abruptly and almost in a whisper. "Is there a room to let?" asked Ardinov, almost forgetting everything he had meant to say. He saw over the old man's shoulder the young woman. The old man began silently closing the door, shutting Ardinov out. "We have a lodging to let," the young woman's friendly voice said suddenly. The old man let go of the door. "I want a corner," said Ardinov, hurriedly entering the room and addressing himself to the beautiful woman. But he stopped in amazement, as though petrified, looking at his future landlord and landlady. Before his eyes, a mute and amazing scene was taking place. The old man was as pale as death, as though on the point of losing consciousness. He looked at the woman with a leaden, fixed, searching gaze. She, too, grew pale at first, then blood rushed to her face, and her eyes flashed strangely. She led Ardinov into another little room. The whole flat consisted of one rather large room, divided into three by 2 partitions. From the outer room they went straight into a narrow, dark passage. Directly opposite was the door, evidently leading to a bedroom the other side of the partition. On the right, the other side of the passage, they went into the room which was to let. It was narrow and pokey, squeezed in between the partition and 2 low windows. It was blocked up with the objects necessary for daily life. It was poor and cramped, but passably clean. The furniture consisted of a plain white table, 2 plain chairs, and a locker that ran both sides of the wall. A big, old-fashioned icon in a gilt wreath stood over a shelf in the corner, and a lamp was burning before it. There was a huge, clumsy Russian stove, partly in this room and partly in the passage. It was clear that it was impossible for 3 people to live in such a flat. They began discussing terms, but incoherently and hardly understanding one another. 2 paces away from her, Ardinov could hear the beating of her heart. He saw she was trembling with emotion and, it seemed, with fear. At last they came to an agreement of some sort. The young man announced that he should move in at once and glanced at his landlord. The old man was standing at the door, still pale, but a quiet, even dreamy smile had stolen onto his lips. Meeting Ardinov's eyes, he frowned again.
"Have you a passport?" he asked suddenly, in a loud and abrupt voice, opening the door into the passage for him.
"Yes," answered Ardinov, suddenly taken aback.
"Who are you?"
"Vasily Ardinov, nobleman, not in the service, engaged in private work," he answered, falling into the old man's tone.
"So am I," answered the old man. "I'm Ilya Murin. Artisan. Is that enough for you? You can go."
An hour later, Ardinov was in his new lodging, to the surprise of himself and of his German, who, together with his dutiful Tinchen, was beginning to suspect that his new lodger had deceived him. Ardinov did not understand how it had all happened, and he did not want to understand.